I am Kathy Engel. I'm the director of ADD Resources, and we have with us tonight Tanya Ruxolenti. And Tanya has done teleconferences for us before, as well as spoken at our annual conferences usually, although not this year, Tanya. We missed you, but we had a great conference.
I heard you think about it.
So, it was very good. It was a wonderful conference. But tonight, Tanya's going to speak to us about how to connect with others. And her title is, I like your title, Tanya, after the title conversation, Creating Contact, Choosing Relationships. And this is a great topic. And it's one that a lot of people with ADD are affected by, that the social connections to people and prioritizing others or tasks, or you know, how do you fit it all in and what works. So just a couple of things. I have muted the line for everybody, but we will if people have questions, they can type them in to Tanya@therapistseattle.net. And there are a couple links on the side there. We have a link on your screen for upcoming webinars, membership benefits to ADD Resources. We do these teleconferences a couple times a month. They go into our members-only section. They're free for everybody initially, but then members have access to over 100 different podcasts and webinars now. It's really amazing. And our membership is fairly inexpensive. It's $45 a year, which I don't think is expensive at all. We also have a bookstore sale going on now, and over 40% off on a number of different titles just because we had a huge inventory and we're kind of smushing it down. So with that, Tanya, I will let you go ahead and start your presentation. Again, if anybody has a question or a comment, you can type it into email tanya@therapistseattle.net. And I will also mute my line, Tanya, so you can, if you need to talk to me, no problem. I'll just give me a second to unmute.
Okay,
so there
great.
You are.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Great. And thank you, all of you who are joining us. I just want to add that Tanya is spelled T-A-N-Y-A because I know there are lots of different spellings for that name. That's not it. This webinar is basically for people who want to feel more loved by and more loving towards their partners. And I want to start out by saying I'm going to be committing the cardinal sin of generalities, because in a class format, I really have to speak to the patterns that I see, the general patterns, and not to specific individual couples. So this is not meant to be inclusive of everybody, but it is actually meant to be informative. So if you hear some things and you think, well, that really doesn't apply to me, take what's useful and leave what isn't useful, because not everything will fit for everyone. And in fact, everything will not fit for anybody who's listening tonight. My intention is we're going to be discussing... Yes.
I'm sorry. I just want to interject one quick second. I forgot to say, I did it initially before I recorded it, but for people that are joining us late, Tanya does not have a PowerPoint presentation. She's not fond of that, which is great. So this is audio only, and I just so you know, Tanya, I did send an email out to all the people that are registered, and there was quite a few, over 40, letting them know it was audio, but they can still join us by computer. Obviously, they save on long-distance charges. So in case people are logging on and thinking, I can't see the slides, I just wanted to add that real quickly. So I'm sorry to interrupt you. So go right ahead.
No problem. And I will add that I have had I have these associations of PowerPoints as being really for speakers who aren't engaging directly with the audience. And frankly, it's so beautiful outside. If you're on telephone, look out a window and take notes if you hear things that are relevant for you. That's way better than staring at your computer screen. So tonight we're going to be discussing the psychological and emotional effects of attention deficit disorder on intimacy, as well as the influence of society on long-term monogamy. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the three relationship deal breakers and why they are so toxic, and then we're going to be reviewing some strategies right the way along to strengthen your relationship. I'm drawing from a variety of sources in this presentation, primarily the emotionally focused therapy approach created by Susan Johnson, who's a Canadian psychologist, as well as Gottman, who's here in Seattle, kind of our local relational rock star. Again, feel free to email me at tanya@therapistseattle.net during the webinar if you have questions and comments. So I'm going to start by laying out my premises about love. I believe that love is a basic need throughout life. I believe that love is a buffer against stress. I believe that love is good for your health. I believe that love is an emotional regulator. And I believe that love facilitates growth and development. To go back to the love being a buffer against stress, there was a recent study in which a person receiving electrical shocks perceived the pain as less frightening and less painful if a loved one was holding their hand while the shocks were being delivered. So if you get nothing else from this webinar, if your partner is going in for a frightening medical test or a procedure, go with them and hold their hand. I'm going to talk now about attention deficit disorder and its influence on intimacy. One of the things that partners of people with attention deficit disorder often miss or often forget is that people with attention deficit disorder walk into the room feeling like they have already done something wrong. Their history of missed deadlines, forgetting important commitments, and repeated sense of failure makes them defensive. How this affects relationships is that often the attention deficit disordered member of the union responds to their partner's requests with a fear of failure, a sense of overwhelm, and then either rejects the requests out of hand or becomes very defensive and sort of slippery. This leads the partner of the attention deficit disorder member to feel unheard and feel resentful. So one thing that attention deficit disordered folks need to keep in mind is that even if they can't fulfill a request perfectly, because none of us are perfect, their willingness to try goes a long ways towards making their partners feel loved and valued. And for those partnered with someone who has attention deficit disorder, they need to keep in mind that their partners have a sensitivity and vulnerability to feeling criticized, and so to frame requests in a collaborative way. What do collaborative requests sound like? What does that mean? Collaborative requests are emotionally neutral and informationally straightforward. You've also heard this framed in terms of I statements, saying things like, I want, I feel, I wish. Direct communication, such as, I'd like us to clean out the garage together, or I'd like us to go out on date nights more often. And by the way, I want to add here that it is vitally important that both members of a couple take turns requesting, initiating, and planning date nights. Because if only one person is doing it, that person feels like they're begging. And if they are self-respecting, eventually they're going to get resentful and give up on the relationship, because it's just no fun to be in a relationship where only one person is initiating and requesting the pleasure of the other person's company. It makes them feel very, very rejected. And I want to emphasize that particularly to men, because one of the things that I see in my work with couples is that oftentimes it's the woman who coordinates the babysitter, requests the date night, plans the date night, and then feels incredibly resentful that her partner seems to feel that showing up is the extent of his responsibility to their relationship. So be sure to look at how, if you are a man and if you have a female partner who has been doing the date night activities, be sure to put in your daily planner, be sure to put on your calendar, or in some way create a tickler system that is reminding you to request and plan for date nights, because that is a really easy way to enhance a relationship. And even if you're not someone who can afford a whole lot, you can switch babysitting with a neighbor, or you can hire a babysitter and then do something very low cost, like go to the Dollar Theater or go for a walk around Green Lake. Or if you're calling from another part of the country, go for a walk around a beautiful park. I want to talk a little bit about society's contribution to intimacy and relationship problems. And I will say, I'm a big critic of the way modern society affects intimacy. For one thing, we have a real consumer mentality. There's such a focus in a capitalistic system on material acquisition. We want bigger, we want better, we want faster, we want more. And I'm really grateful to live in a society where I have so many choices when it comes to buying a new personal computer, which I had to do last week. But long-term monogamy is not glamorous. It's often quite boring, and the gifts it offers are the very opposite of the marketing machine, which encourages people to fix any discomfort or dissatisfaction by just acquiring more stuff. The gifts of long-term monogamy include being deeply and truly known by another person. We actually create and sustain our very identities based on how we are treated by those closest to us. So as an example of this, a bright child who is told that he is stupid will perform poorly at school, and conversely, an average child who's told he is smart will outperform children with equal IQs. So one immediate way to improve your relationship is to mirror back to your partner all of the good qualities you recognize in him or her. Another way that society undermines intimacy is by providing tons of examples in the media, in movies, and in songs on the radio about young love. Now, young love, we all know, is the early, highly emotionally and sexually charged period of the relationship. But there's hardly any role models about mature love, because middle-aged adults, we're simply less glamorous than 20-year-olds. And the intense adrenaline of young love is literally exciting to watch, whereas the inside jokes and shared experiences and nuance of mature love, it can't be captured in a two-hour movie, and it's not going to make any money for Hollywood. So we're going to talk a little bit now about developing realistic expectations. I live in Seattle, and in Seattle there's a neighborhood called Capitol Hill. And in Capitol Hill, there was a mural on the side of a building that said, "I'll always love the false image I had of you." And I love this mural because I think it's hysterically funny and just deeply true. Again, music and movies portray love as a cure-all for any number of personal problems. And so while it's true that young love is delightfully distracting from our personal problems, if you stay in the relationship, eventually you're left with the realization that you and your partner are two imperfect human beings. So developing realistic expectations includes letting go of the idea that young love is a sustainable experience in a relationship. It is not. It is fraught with anxiety. It is infused with adrenaline. It is super exciting. And it's ephemeral. It does not last. Another way we can cultivate realistic expectations is to normalize conflict. In fact, what research tells us about relationships is that it's not couples who fight who don't make it. It's couples who fail to do the repair work after conflict who don't make it. And we're going to talk a little bit about what that repair looks like and when it's going well and what it looks like when it's not going well. But the piece around developing realistic expectations is expect conflict, expect boredom. Expect both of those things in any relationship that you stay in long enough to become familiar with one another. I'm going to talk a little bit about male and female patterns and kind of the enduring challenges that I see. And for those of you who are not in heterosexual relationships, take this information in and ask yourself within the relationship that you may be in or have been in the past, does one of you shake into some general male patterns and one of you shake into some general female patterns? Because I certainly do not mean to make this presentation exclusively for heterosexual couples. So men and women each have some distinct problems with the development of realistic expectations. Women often fail to prioritize themselves in their own lives. This leads to a mistaken fantasy or an unrealistic expectation that their partner will somehow psychically know what she needs and heroically give it to her. When this doesn't happen, she gets mad and tries to manipulate rather than assertively expressing and pursuing her needs. So going back to the I statements, one of the things that women really need to work on is being able to ask for what they need. And the other piece that they really need to work on is going after their needs directly in themselves. So working on cultivating self-care without apology. Now, self-care includes taking time away from work and family in order to be with friends, pursue hobbies, to be alone in nature, to develop and nurture their relationships with themselves. Women are so good, especially in this era of being both primary parents as well as working full-time. Women are so good at adding extra upon extra upon extra things on their plate by, you know, volunteering for the PTA and offering to run the fundraiser for the soccer team. And that's all well and good as long as it's part of a balanced and holistic life in which she is able to be good selfish. Good selfish meaning doing the things that are benefiting and for herself exclusively, not in service to her family, not in service to her career, not in service to the activities that are that involve her children. Now, men, on the other hand, lack social permission to create emotionally self-revealing relationships with other men. I have a theory that one of the things that happens in a patriarchy is that men become so afraid of revealing their vulnerabilities that they feel this longing to connect on a deep emotional level with other men, but they surrender it and decide that they'll only get their emotional needs met in their relationship with their woman. Therefore, the woman becomes their sole source of emotional food and the only relationship in which they can be vulnerable. And frankly, this puts too much pressure on the primary relationship. Because no matter how much you love eating bananas, if all you ever eat is bananas, you get really tired of bananas. And so what happens is the man gets really mad at the woman for not fulfilling him in all the myriad ways he needs to be fulfilled. And the woman gets really mad at the male expectations placed upon her. So the solution is that men need to work on pursuing friendships with other men in which they can be emotionally honest. Now, I've been a master's level social worker for 15 years, and every single man I have worked with, be it in a couple or be it individually, has expressed a longing for this kind of depth and connection with other men. Every single one. So, women, I want you to ask the men in your life, your partner, your father, your brother, your best friend's husband, how to be more assertive. Really borrow from their skills because men tend to be brilliant at this. And men, I want you to ask the women in your life, your partner, your mom, your sister, your best friend's wife, how to be more socially vulnerable. An interesting piece of Gottman's research is around the male acceptance of female influence. What that means is Gottman did a whole lot of, you know, variables and correlation and longitudinal studies, and he came up with one of the leading predictors of marital success is the male acceptance of female influence. What this means is men who are willing to accept the influence, the perspective, the advice of their women, both the male and the female wind up being more satisfied in those relationships. And that again speaks to the willingness to be vulnerable, the willingness to accept the intelligence and the insight and the authority of the woman in their life without feeling defensive and needing to reject it. So I'm going to talk now about three deal breakers. And first, let me give you a little context about the deal breakers. I work with couples. And if I have a couple coming in the door and I do a telephone screening before I accept anybody into work with me, be it individually or in a couple, I ask about these three A's is what they're called. And if there's a couple that wants to come into therapy and they have one of the three A's active in their life, I will not see them. Because I know that it will be a frustrating waste of my time and a frustrating waste of their money for them to enter couples therapy. Those three A's are addiction, adultery, abuse. Active addiction, active adultery, active abuse. The word active means it's currently happening. Any of these factors, addiction, affairs, abuse, can be successfully managed if the perpetrator, meaning the person engaging in them, is willing to take responsibility, get help, and do the maintenance required to prevent reoccurrence. I'm going to spend some special time tonight talking about addiction and why it's a deal breaker, because addiction is so commonly a co-occurring disorder for attention deficit disorder, particularly folks with impulsive type attention deficit disorder. So I'm going to talk about addictions and their effect on relationships at some length, and I'm going to ask you to bear with me if it does not pertain to you. The reason that all three of these are deal breakers is that trust and respect are the two most important traits of a successful long-term relationship. And the sneakiness and denial required in active addiction and active adultery undermine trust. And obviously, abuse completely erases trust. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more about abuse and the nuances of abuse later on, but I just want to say active abuse includes physical abuse as well as emotional abuse. Coming back to all three of these together, we can't give to others what we don't give ourselves. Respect is heavily tied to esteem. Esteem comes from feeling proud of ourselves for accomplishing challenging tasks. And people who are active in addiction are not respecting themselves, and so they can't give respect or earn respect of their partners. The good news is that kicking an addiction and humbling oneself enough to get help is incredibly challenging, but it offers both the gift of recovery as well as an immediate boost in self-esteem because it's so difficult. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about my general definition of addiction, because some people will say, well, you know, I might drink every day or I might binge drink until I pass out on the weekends, but I'm not homeless or I'm not, you know, fill in the blank. My general definition of an addiction is any behavior which starts out as being comforting or soothing and becomes an interference to the relationship, to relationships plural, to work, and feels so important that the person doing it that they are unwilling to change their own behavior even when faced with multiple negative consequences. Most addicts are the very last people to admit that they are addicted because they don't want to lose the behavior which once brought them so much comfort and joy. It's kind of like asking someone to give up their coat in the wintertime. Unless they have an alternate source of warmth, they don't want to do that. Now, the non-addict in the relationship has a very hard time understanding how much the addict feels scared of losing their comfort. And that's why a 12-step program filled with people who know exactly how the addict feels is needed, and why Al-Anon, which is the 12-step program for the partners, is so great for in terms of what the partner of the addict can do. So unlike the reputation that 12-step programs often have, which is really mistaken. You don't have to be Christian. You don't have to believe in God. It's a community support that's free, that's in every city, and is just fabulous for your mental health. Now, I'm going to go back to adultery for a minute. For those who are engaged in adulterous relationships, you cannot invest in and build a primary relationship while concurrently investing in building secret relationships. It just doesn't work. If you're not sure about your current relationship, which is often the adulterer's kind of underlying fuzzy logic, which is, ooh, I'm not quite sure if this relationship is working out, and therefore I need to have a little something-something on my on the side. If you're not sure about your current relationship, deal with it by directly expressing your ambivalence and getting feedback from your partner and his or her ambivalence as well. You can see a couple therapists together or an individual therapist alone to explore how you can get your needs met in a direct and an honest way. I'm going to talk now a little bit about the third A, which is abuse. Of course, there's physical abuse, which is actually a crime, and hopefully none of you need to know that if you are engaging in physical abuse of your partner, you're not just committing a crime, you are creating a legacy of violence as a method of solving problems. And if you have children, you're imprinting upon them that this is the effective way to try to solve problems. It becomes an intergenerational pattern. It's just absolutely toxic all around. Emotional abuse is a bit more subtle and harder to diagnose, because people who are engaging in emotional abuse of their partners will often be able to rationalize and say, well, I'm just, you know, giving them feedback, or I'm just being honest, or I'm just responding in the way that anybody would. And I would say, think of emotional abuse as name-calling, character assassination, threats. If you're doing any of those things, you're not feeding the trust, and you're not feeding the respect. And those, again, are the two most important qualities in a long-term relationship. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the brain, because I love the brain. I'm a big brain nerd. We're all neurologically wired to attend to threats first. We're all the products of ancestors who successfully attended to danger and survived to pass along their genetic code. And thus, we are both individually and collectively wired to look for the problems and to focus on them. And this actually is a really successful habit in a lot of arenas. For one thing, it has helped us survive when there's an actual physical danger. For another thing, focusing on problems, what we call the problem-solving approach, leads to success in academic and professional settings. Because if you can identify at school that you have a difficulty with spelling, you can increase your studying of spelling, and then you can become a good speller. Or if you identify at work that you have a particular difficulty with some aspect of your job, you can focus on that and come up with a plan for it and overcome it. However, the problem-solving or problem-finding approach can create discouragement and despair in an intimate setting. It's useful only in a larger context, again, of trust and mutual respect. One of the things that is repeatedly shown is that whatever we focus on grows. There's a process that researchers call confirmation bias, which basically is a fancy way of saying whatever you look for, you're sure going to find it. And I'm sure those of you who have gone out and bought a car have noticed that as soon as you drive, say, a white Subaru station wagon, you're going to be noticing all the white Subaru station wagons on the road. That is a form of confirmation bias. Now, the problem-solving focus, again, is something that we're really neurologically hardcore wired to do. However, on an interpersonal level, it can be really problematic. And I'm going to talk for a minute here about employee evaluations, because one of the interesting things that has happened in the business setting recently is that employers are getting hip to the idea that if they focus their employee evaluations solely on the employee's strengths, the employees will, of their own accord, address their weaknesses. In other words, focusing on the strengths actually is so much more effective than focusing on the deficits, because, of course, focusing on the deficits creates shame, creates defensiveness, creates resistance. So as long as there's not one of the three deal breakers, again, active affairs, active adultery, active abuse, active addiction in play, it's a good idea to use the Gottman ratio of 5 compliments to every 1 complaint, because complaints are more painful and, unfortunately, easier to remember than the compliments. Now, am I saying if one of the three deal breakers is on board that you should only complain? No. If one of the deal breakers is on board, you should get help or get out. I'm going to be really clear about that. If one of the three deal breakers is on board, is active in your relationship, get help or get out, because you cannot feel like you're going to get your needs met if your partner is not participating in the relationship in a way that helps you feel trust, respect, and safety. So the other thing I want to talk about is the concept of love courage. Now, when you put your child to bed at night, you don't say to your child at bedtime, well, your spelling is terrible and your room is a mess and I hate the way you leave toothpaste gobs in the sink, even if it's true. You say to your kid at bedtime, good night, I love you. And you do that because you know that what your child needs when you're sending him or her off to sleep is to feel encouraged, to feel loved, to feel safe. And it's easy to be in touch with that for our kids because we were all children once. One of the things that I think is kind of challenging about heterosexual relationships is that I've never been a man, and a man has never been a woman. So it's easier for us to relate to our children regardless of their gender because in many ways we've already been that, which they are. But adults need the same love courage that children effortlessly garner from their parents. Another way that our children can teach us how to be with our partners is to notice the instinctual activities of a mother or a father with a baby. What happens when a parent is holding their infant is they'll hold that baby in a way that allows them to make eye contact, and they'll have deep, sustained eye contact. Eye contact creates an emotional and physiological attunement. People who look into one another's eyes will actually start respirating in union. And if you remember back to the beginning of your relationship, that early love phase that we were talking about, when we're in our early love phase, we just do that eye contact naturally, right? We're so crazy about that person, and they're so crazy about us that we do all this eye contact. So my recommendation is that you take some time, even set the timer for 3 or 4 minutes, and just hold hands and make eye contact and try to do that regularly. Try to do that daily. It's good for babies and it's good for adults too. And what you'll find is that experience of witnessing and being witnessed allows you to open into that love in a really beautiful and safe way. And I think one of the things that happens over the course of a love relationship, moving from young love into mature love, is that all these responsibilities come up and get in the way. We have kids, we have a mortgage, we have a career, we have, volunteer activities. And so early on in the relationship, there's usually less that is required of us outside of the relationship. And then over time, the sort of social pressures and social expectations pull us away from one another. So even if it seems a little mechanistic, and I will say that the Gottman method, although I have a lot of appreciation for it, my one criticism is that it can feel a little mechanistic, you know, the idea of, you know, doing this in this way or doing that in that way. It can kind of raise our defenses because we have this ideal of having this sort of organic, natural response. And so for those of you who are resistant to that idea, I would say give yourself permission to feel the resistance. Absolutely. It's kind of wacky to think of setting a timer and staring into your partner's eyes, right? But try it a few times. And then if it feels like it's good enough of a help that you're willing to deal with kind of feeling a little dorky for a while, then just kind of go with that. And I'm going to have a lot of suggestions that might seem a little wacky. Another thing is making declarations to your partner that involve consciously and currently making the choice to be together. One of the things that I really love is to have couples say to each other while making eye contact, "I love you and I choose you." Because what can happen is over time, it can start to feel like we're in a relationship out of habit rather than out of conscious choice. And both members of the couple can feel that way. And it's amazing how just making that declaration of intention, of love and choice, can help both people focus again on being intentionally present in the relationship. Going back to the 3 deal breakers, one of the problems with any of those deal breakers is that we can't be intentionally present in the moment if we don't feel secure in our connection with our partner. And in order to feel secure in our connection with our partner, we need to feel like they're emotionally present also. So try that, try the eye contact, and try also saying, "I love you and I choose you." So, of course, we all enter relationships with our own history of love. The families we grew up in, as well as our previous intimate and social relationships, shape our expectations and needs and wants. people who did not get their emotional needs for security, love, and stimulation met as a young person are going to probably enter an adult relationship with a much stronger charge to either be totally in control or to be totally taken care of. And either of these postures, the rigidity of the controller or the chaos of the collapser, can be explored and addressed in therapy. Most of us in the mental health profession will jokingly state that we just want our children to need less therapy than we have needed. But the truth is, behind the joke is that many, if not most, people could benefit from some type of therapy, particularly during times of life transition. So if you're in a relationship that's not feeling satisfying and sustainable, consider seeing a couples therapist to add to your communication and management and conflict management skills. And I'm going to go back to this concept of the posture of the rigidity of the controller or the chaos of the collapser. One of the ways that we think about couples in the emotionally focused therapy paradigm is to think about the critical pursuer and the withdrawer. And usually in a relationship, there's one person who's sort of fighting for the connection and is presenting with much more anger, much more dissatisfaction. And then we have the other person, and the other person is sort of in some ways along for the ride, is oftentimes a lot quieter, more emotionally shut down in general, really just wants the relief of their partner to leave them alone and stop badgering them. And the piece that is sometimes missed by the people who are in that couple is that what the pursuer, the critical one, or the controlling one is asking for is for the withdrawing person to provide evidence that the withdrawing person actually wants to be in the relationship. So going back a few clicks to the concept of planning date night, oftentimes in couples, the female will show up. Excuse me. The female will show up as the critical pursuer, and the male will show up as the withdrawer, the shutdown withdrawer. And part of how the critical pursuer will do her dance of distress or ask him to show up is by, asking his advice about a decision that needs to be made. I'm going to drink some water. Thank you. She'll ask his advice about a decision that's made, or she'll ask him to participate more with the kids, or she'll make requests that essentially the heart of the request is, will you participate more? And the withdrawer will respond by feeling criticized or feeling attacked and then withdrawing even more. And so if you find yourself in this dance, one of the ways to immediately shut it down is to say, oh, here we are in this dance. And you can even have a little humor and say something like, oh, now you're going to do this, or now I'm going to do that, and then we'll just be, fully in the pattern. So once you can start getting some space from the pattern by identifying it and looking at the dance steps, as it were, you can start substituting other activities. I read kind of an interesting little statistic which said, if you find yourself in a habitual pattern of conflict, add one unexpected element. So, for instance, couples most frequently will fight about money. And so if you find yourself fighting about money, you would go into the kitchen and both of you would put on oven mitts, and you would have your fight about money while wearing oven mitts. And just adding one random unexpected element opens up just enough space within that pattern that new things can start to unfold. Because it doesn't feel good to feel stuck. It doesn't feel good to feel like you're doing the same thing over and over and over again, getting no relief, getting no traction, making no change. Because as human beings, we need to have a sense of progress. We need to have evidence that our existence matters to our partner and that we're moving together through time towards this common goal of leading a pleasant, productive, serviceful, fun life together. There are a couple books that I recommend. One is Hold Me Tight by Susan Johnson. That's the book that she wrote for the public on the model of therapy that she created and teaches called Emotionally Focused Therapy. Now, Emotionally Focused Therapy is not to be confused with the other EFT, which stands for Emotional Freedom Technique, which is like a tapping, like some kind of energy tapping thing, which I'm sure has its proponents, and I'm not here to put it down by any means, but it's not the same thing. The other book is by a psychotherapist named Terrence Real, and it's called How Can I Get Through to You? And he is a therapist who really focuses in with a laser-like vision on some of the differences between how males and females communicate and how that really shuts down or can really shut down the process of feeling intimate and connected and open. Now, I'm checking my email, and I don't see any emails. Okay. So, actually, I do have an email that says, FYI, your email address is not on my screen, but fortunately, it was read aloud twice. Thank you for the person who sent that. And I want to invite those of you who have comments or questions at this time to send an email to Tanya, T-A-N-Y-A, at therapistseattle.net. And now I'm just going to recap as I wait those emails. So to recap, love is a basic need. Attention deficit disordered folk have a defensiveness towards criticism that comes from a lifetime of feeling as though they have failed. Society holds up models of young love as if that is the only kind of love that counts, and it isn't. And men and women both need to develop realistic expectations of love and relationships. Women in particular need to prioritize themselves and ask directly for what they want. And men need to develop deep emotional relationships with other men. The three deal breakers, in which case I as a couples therapist will not work with a couple, and I will advise my individual clients to get help or get out, are active addiction, active affairs, or active abuse. We are neurologically wired and then socially reinforced to focus on problems rather than acceptance or appreciation. We can use our instinctual responses to our children to inform our relationship skills. And therapy can help us unpack some of the unconscious influences of our families of origin. And, okay, I still don't have any comments or questions on my email. Kathy, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Great. I've actually reached the end of my information. I'm a little embarrassed. I apologize.
Don't be. Well, you know, we have like 20 people that are joining us by computer, and we have another 10 probably that are on the line. I can unmute the line to see if anybody has a question they'd like to ask on the line if you
Wonderful.
Like.
Please do.
Let me do that now. Interactive mode. Okay, so everybody, we can hear everybody now. So does anybody on the line have a question for Tanya? And while they're thinking about the question, I would like to say thank you. I think that that's wonderful information, and it's really good to have knowledge about for just couples. And I like that you can speak to sort of everybody. You know, obviously people that have ADD have, or I shouldn't say obviously, but many people that have ADD have problems with relationships or just social issues, but it affects everybody. So I think that that's great. So does anybody on the line have a question for Tanya or want to email a question to Tanya?
And I just got an email who said, from somebody, actually I got two emails saying, can you repeat the name of the books that I suggest? And yes, the books are Hold Me Tight by Susan Johnson. That is Hold Me Tight by Susan Johnson. And the other book I recommend is called How Can I Get Through to You by Terrence Real. And one person has emailed me and said, what to do if you are alone and still want to try to save the marriage? So such a good question. And unfortunately, I don't have enough information from that question to really formulate an intelligent or thoughtful answer. What I would say is that you can always focus on improving your own life. You can always focus on becoming the healthiest person who you can be, so that regardless of whether your marriage becomes stronger or winds up ending, and then you are in the position of seeking out another relationship, you're still the healthiest person you can be. Oh, and I have another question or comment. This is from someone who said, I listened to an interview with Susan Johnson about her book a couple of years ago and highly recommend her book. Wonderful. Thank you. That's from Donna Leah. Yeah, I do too. Anybody else have anything they want to say or ask? And again, I want to say again, everybody listening on the line has a variety of experiences, insight, and wisdom that they can offer me as well as the other listeners, and you are a part of this experience if you choose to be.
So, Tanya, you had read out your email address, but if you could give people your website too, that would be
absolutely
great information.
And
also, and you have a blog, so that would be helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy. So my website is therapistseattle.net, and I also write a blog called Trauma Blog, and the website for the blog is seattletherapist.wordpress.org. And the Trauma Blog is basically a blog about mental health topics. It includes relationships, parenting, individual mental health, and my professional website also has articles about anxiety, depression, co-occurring disorders, and attention deficit disorder. So I just want to say thank you very much for your time and attention. And if you have any questions or comments, even after this telephone call is over, please feel free to email me. And I just really appreciate your attention tonight. Thank you.
And thank you, Tanya. And if anybody missed anything, or we had a number of people that came in late, I noticed. So if you go back and you click on this same link, it will be the replay after I hit end. It will be the replay of the conversation. So feel free to do that. And I want to thank you, Tanya, very much for being with us tonight, and for everybody else that took time out of their night to listen to an important issue, social issues and relationships. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care, everybody. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.